This somehow kills everything that contains H star, so it one kind of view called Vibra, but sometimes you can identify now with DOH. And this is a co-commutative co-algebra in this category without doing that stuff. But it's also infinitesimally co-commutative. That's because we are modeled by this A star. We take this co-invariance number, something that's happening here. Oh, my thing called. And that's why this stuff is going to be with the original co-product. We don't deform anything. The original co-product is going to stay co-commutative, co-associative here. Very well. And what is C? This would be vector spaces, particle vector spaces. We don't deform anything here. We want to have two vector spaces. And what is F? F is a functor going from D to C, to vector spaces. And I told you one nice braided monoidal functor which goes like that is taking, if you want a conoidal functor, which should take now co-invariance. So F D is D mod H times D. So this we already know. So there is a braided co-commutative or something, a commonodial functor, sorry. And now it's a simple check that F kills one Q, that you can imagine that if you multiply by a copy of UH, but then we model by the action of H, it's precisely this UH is going to disappear from the picture. So it has the right property, and FQ of Q is naturally identified here. One doesn't use any associate or anything, we're simply working with Eugene Hadley's representation. This thing is simply. As the vector space is naturally identified with this stuff. And there are somehow two copies with UH times UH, but we model by the diagonal action of H, so we end up with one with a single copy of UH. And now this is supposed to be a Hopf algebra in vector spaces. And now say a simple calculation that I'll skip reveals that it is really a deformation of this type. The only calculation one needs to do is to check that we get this delta somewhere in this delta, and it comes from.
You actually didn't even say what T was, but you didn't even say what T was.
I just said that we have Drinfeld double, so sorry if this was. Okay, this was incomprehensible for anybody who doesn't know what a algebra is, but then I simply decided it would anyway be incomprehensible for anybody. So I skip this thing.
Okay.
But yes, invariant inner product on G, which is just the pairing between H and A star. It's a vector space, it's H plus A star. The pairing here becomes a inner product. If you invert it, it becomes this T, which is in S2G. And it can be reasonably expressed also in these terms. If H is a three-dimensional, it still makes sense. Okay, so we quantize the two algebras. It would be now nice to compare it with the original quantization of the thing that was done. You see, I'm talking about things that actually solved 20 years ago, so it's an old stuff, so everybody meanwhile forgot that that these things can still be solved, so my try didn't work. But unfortunately, I don't have enough time to now explain what those two important people did. But just some kind of, see, I should say which one is better. So people agree. Now this becomes psychologically difficult, but let's say that this one is better. In what sense? But it's also, let me also say why it's worse. So it's just to explain.
They have actually two solutions, sort of paper one and paper two with two slightly different solutions.
Yeah. But for the dimensional.
One is, one works only in finite dimensions and the other is in any dimension. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's already in the paper one that they prove it for infinite dimensional. But it's also part one.
Oh, maybe one, it's part one and part two of the same paper. Sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, so in what sense is this construction better? To start with good news. It's technically much simpler. So the general idea of ethical Poisson quantization is nice and very, you know, very, very nice. But at least for me, reading these papers, it becomes quite, these technical parts become rather involved. Here, it's maybe, I don't know, maybe it was not so nice, but there is nothing hidden here. There are no horrors behind. The reason for why this is happening is that, see, naturally, what they're talking about in some natural comprehensible way, they do have to speak about the dual of H. So the thing becomes somehow rather bad when this H is infinite dimensional and they are fighting in a way they need to introduce some equicontinuous modules and things become difficult. And they cannot stay within this category. In the end, they still can rephrase the construction without talking about any H star, but then this conceptual thing behind, at least for me, disappears. On the other hand, it's precisely for this reason why this construction is worse than their construction, because their construction is explicitly self-dual. For them, there is the passage between H and H star is completely natural, because what they're doing, they're first quantizing the dream for double of H. So the first quantizing G as to get a bigger algebra, but an insider want to find this sub-algebra. And things are self-dual, whereas here the self-duality disappears, which makes things simpler, but maybe also something, there's something that we'll see.
But then in this connection, how is it? Does it mean if you repeat the same construction for H star, right? Because you can do it for H star, so you will get another Hopf algebra. So these two Hopf algebras, there would be no obvious relation between them, right?
I don't see an obvious relation.
So this would be kind of difficult, or whatever.
Or maybe not so difficult. But, yeah, I thought. 2 hours is infinite time, but as it always happens, it's not. No. So I will not get to parts where those things now might start to make some sense. Okay, maybe one, just let me make it work. To a remark, I told you that this construction of Hopf algebras is construction of all Hopf algebras and nothing but Hopf algebras. So let me tell you in what sense. Now we can forget about this quantization thing. In the following, imagine that we have this situation that we have Q, E, and F. Now, in this construction, D was a complicated thing. Radical, that's where the associator went. But actually, what we can do, and then it goes rather to F, we can always replace D with something much simpler. We can call it universal D. This is a Brady monoidal category, which is generated by a single object, and that single object is a co-commutative co-algebra. So all objects are just tensor powers of this object, and all morphisms just come from identities and from coproduct and co-unit, things like that. So to make sense, so what are the morphisms here? There should be also some bracketing of those objects, but that's not terribly important. Now, morphisms would be something like this, that things can can split. They can also, you know, maybe start trading. Let's go maybe here to another object. And we can also apply coordinates somewhere. But in the end, what it is, whenever we apply coordinates, this trend simply goes down here. And whenever there is a cover that we can imagine is happening at the very beginning. So this is some kind of category of braids which are now not bijectively attached at the bottom, but bijectively attached at the top, but not bijectively at the bottom. This is a very simple category, braiding monomer category. And it's a universal category containing a co-commutative co-algebra, this is this dot. So which means that whenever we have another one, there is a unique functor here, which is given by the fact this is dot going to Q, it's some kind of universal Q. Mm-hmm. And so it means that now we can simply compose those two things in some kind of new F. With this new Q and new F, everything still works. It satisfies the same properties as before because, well, nothing happened really. We simply removed everything from D which was not necessary, we only keep powers of Q and this happening. So you can always think about having just this universal D. Now the statement is that if C is a very normal category and H in C is a Hopf algebra with invertible antipodes, so it's only giving Hopf algebras with an invertible antipode, I should say. Then there is unique F going from D universal to C such that F of QQ is equal to H and it gives the right Hopf algebra structure. One can rephrase it also in somewhat different way. So, rephrasing is that we can actually construct now the universal C. There is universal C, so any nice functor from universal D to C passes through this universal C. So, okay, some kind of this F universal C universal. The geometric picture of the C is some kind of trees with veins. I don't really understand how what's going on, but something like here the geometric picture were some braids, and then those braids are happening in some trees which are also braiding.
And from C universal there is a function.
Yeah,
to C.
And now, so the statement is that whenever we have an F, in what sense is it universal? So whenever we have an F going to C, there is now a unique way coming from here. And in other words, it says that the C unit is the, okay, if it works in the braided word, and it's equivalent to the braided prop of Hopf algebras. If you restrict ourselves to C's that are symmetric monoidal, then it's equivalent to the prop, the ordinary symmetric prop of Hopf algebras. It's somehow, in this sense, it's a universal construction of Hopf algebras. Okay, so I hope I made it mysterious enough. And now let me try to tell you something about the second half of the talk.
In the proof of the statement is just to construct the universal directly by hand,
yeah.
Then
okay. The proof of this statement follows from this statement. I mean, this statement comes from this statement. This can be constructed by just inverting something. So one needs to prove this, roughly speaking.
So C universal is some utilization of D universal?
Yes. It's okay. You see, this F was just a varied commonical functor, but satisfying some invertibility properties. So you first construct without those invertibility properties, you just construct universal varied commonical functor. There is sort of, well, this can be done explicitly, those are those trees with veins, you need to be able to split things in also in C, something like that. And, but then you need to impose this invertibility, so you localize in C, you impose that some morphisms are invertible, and that's how you construct this universe of C. And this existence and uniqueness, okay, it's, well, let me not get to the second part of the talk. You see, the only objects here are just powers of the dot. So we should be able to say, to find F. We should be able to say what is dot power, you know, in plus one, or any n. And as you remember, it should be just h power n. But this dot is now this universal cube. So this should be just h power n. So at least an object is now it's defined. Now we should understand what is dot, how it was happening on morphisms, why is uniquely defined there, and one can see, compute from other side and then prove that it works from the other side, to see that it exists and is unique, to prove things like that, of a generator of the Braid group, if you apply something like that, it becomes, in this language, something now, you see, those H's are between those dots. So this is the place, this is the nth place, this place where this is happening. And what we need to do, we have to apply the coproduct twice. We apply the product here and then you apply the antipode. Now it's not difficult to prove that these things satisfy these Artin's relations for the Braid group. If the antipode is invertible, one can prove that these things are invertible, so it's really a representation of the Braid group. And then there are a few other morphisms to look at. We need to say what's happening if we apply coproduct somewhere. It's another morphism which is happening with D universal. But we know somehow what to do, we just should... There is a new copy of H here appearing, we should put there one.
So can you explain a bit more, what does this picture mean? The right hand side
is... This is a map going from H tensor N. There are N of those H's.
And on the left hand side, this are...
On the left hand side, this is in D unit. So this is a morphism going from this to itself. It's an automorphism of this object.
Okay.
And I'm just saying, computing things says that this has to go here, and then once you know the formula, you can start proving that F exists if you have H. Mm-hmm. This morphism corresponds to putting one here. This one new H appearing, we just put one in the place. And there is another morphism which is that we have this counit. And we also know what's happening here, which is some two H's are replaced by one, we should put there this product. And then one needs to prove that indeed this is a functor. One indeed can prove it. But it's so hard. But one cannot prove it in a nice way. Okay, so what is the... Maybe... Just look. One little comment, just for you, again. Is that still in this quantization of Lie by algebras, Everything depends on an associator, on the associator, except for one thing, except for the antipode. Because, as I told you, the antipode is just this f of, but for some reasons I have to put it, it's opposite of the gradient, it's fine. Because of some definition somewhere in the of the infelding, finally I have to put it like that, but it doesn't really matter. So this is the deformed antipode. There's no associator happening here, there are just two strands. It's not, nothing is ever being rebracketed. And what is it? This is what the ordinary associator composed with the exponential of the 1/2 of h bar, and there's this natural automorphism of any Levi algebra, which is now which is of this form that we apply the Lie take the Lie bracket and then take the Lie bracket. That thing. In particular, it means that if this is zero, which is what's called an involuted Levi algebra, then the antipode doesn't get deformed, and its square, but the square of the antipode is just this without that 1/2, as you could imagine. And so it's, one can say the deformed thing is an involuted Hopf algebra if and only if the Levi algebra was involuted. It's perfectly possible that the same thing is true for a thing of Cartan quantization. I just never really looked at it. But it's just some kind. Another remark.
Maybe that depends on the situation. This is true for all quantization.
It also makes sense. Okay, so. What I still wanted to tell you is some of, now let me go away from this problem of just quantization of Levi algebra, trying to find all Hopf algebra. Let us come back to this general engineering procedure of how to find some nice associative algebras, which are deformations of commutative algebras. Rephrase the story now purely in Newton's cartoon. So, as I told you, if you have two algebras, then their tensor product is again an algebra. But since at least when it takes the C infinity of M tensor C infinity of N, that's not quite C infinity of on N times N. You can always put there some hat, but then. It's difficult to make it in LaTeX, I don't know, so but it's maybe safer to not to make completions where completions are not really small at the heart of the matter. There is no topology going on really. So we can extend this procedure a little bit in the following sense. Suppose that now that we have a single A, so if A is an algebra, so it will be like this A tensor B for lambda not a single thing, but it's rather in a, with two actions of G, so it's in a UG plus G mod A plus I. So suppose that we have two actions of G, this would be a field. What would happen in this C infinity of n times n, but also might happen in some more general situations, so it's helpful to look at it. Then, in the same A, but with a deformed n, with a deformed product, is an algebra in U G. How is it happening? We just apply the same stuff as before. Let me phrase it in this way. Why should that such thing happen? Because we have a functor going from U G plus G modulus P. G modulus, which is simply replacing, which is just forgetting part of this G, so remembering only the diagonal. So let me put here some old diagonal. That's what we have. And this functor can be made to a strongly monoidal functor. And how do we do it? We apply the same stuff as before. So you see, before we were supposed to exchange things, and only then we were applying the original product. Now, that stuff can be thought of, or if you apply it as an associate, it can be seen as a thing in the enveloping algebra of T4, but finally for us, we would see it as somebody who is from UG, maybe, okay, that's about 4, h bar. So this is done on the monoidal structure on the factors of coherence, something called its code, I forgot. And so, let me call it J, this element. And the new product on A, what is it? M mu is M O precomposed with the action of this J. See, this J has 4 copies of G. Now, this is supposed to be applied on 2 copies of A, so there are those 4 copies of G can act on 2 copies of A. This is what's happening. This is how we compute a new product. As I said, this is just a small generalization of what was happening here, with exactly the same proof in the end. The properties of J that make it work are the same properties that made it work before. Why they make A tensor E to be an integer. I should finish soon. So
maybe I'm completely lost, but doesn't there need to be some associativity property for your sort of unified A? Or am I?
So it's an algebra, I mean associative algebra. I mean
no, but one that corresponds.
I mean, this is a stronger statement than that one, that I admit. But the proof of this stronger statement uses exactly the same properties of J as this weaker statement. So it's only seemingly stronger statement.
Okay.
And so what we can now do, so imagine some kind of this general procedure of how this works. So suppose that we have a manifold M. I'm now going to talk about manifolds and we'll be interested in geometry and deformation quantities. And this A would really be C infinity of M. Let's start with an action of a relatively big V algebra. Let's suppose that there is a G1, several copies of G1, say K1 plus this is Gn. Okay, sir. And let's suppose that this action is with coisotropic stabilizers. Actually commutative algebra even when we introduce it as associator, so it's a commutative associative algebra. Not very interesting, but we know now what we can do. Whenever you see there is maybe one still little generalization one needs to introduce. You can imagine there might be some additional algebra, some G prime that doesn't, some which is just kind of spectator, it doesn't do anything. Nothing is happening with respect to this G prime. This statement is still true as written. So we can now try to replacing these copies of G1 with fewer copies and fewer copies, perhaps with a single copy. Then apply this procedure which is there. We will see it on M with action of just those diagonal algebra. G1 plus Gn. And now on this, still on the same A, we have a new product, which is obtained from the original old product by pre-composing it with several copies of those J's, where the, now, of course, those G's might be different G's and they act differently, but it's just...
Sorry, I probably kind of forgot. How is it the resulting product or resulting big J? Does it depend on the order?
Yes, it depends on the... Doesn't depend on bracketing, modulo some isomorphisms, but it does depend on the order, how we order these G1s, which are here. So imagine there is some G1 plus, etc. And we start replacing with them with diagonals. So we replace say, this pair with the diagonal, this pair, etc. Finally, we end up with a single G. Then the outcome is up to an explicit isomorphism, which is coherent in a way. It doesn't depend on how we did it, but it depends on the order of how we wrote it. If each change means we get a different algebra, genuinely a different algebra. And this is still.
It depends how we take diagonals, not how we write the properties.
So, finally, what's happening is, it seems that it depends on how we take those diagonals, but
yes. What
it depends on is really the order of how we order those G1s here, and those G2s, and G3s, and Gn's. This is not yet some interesting thing, it's an algebra in some strange category, but then finally we take some H here, which is quite topic. And then we say that the same product restricted to H invariants, or which take invariants, supposing that deduction is nice, and each H would be a manifold. We get a star product on this manifold. Now, what is the manifold? And what is the Poisson structure which is being quantized to a star product here? Coming, I cannot basically only tell you some kind of fairy tale of what's happening. So what kind of spaces in the end we quantize? So this part of the talk is joint work with the and the spaces of this form. It's a creation of Anton and his collaborators. Whenever we have surface with boundary and with some marked points on the boundary, then we can look at the moduli space of flat G connections. over the surface with the trivialization over those framing over the smart point boundary, which is the same, which is the same as homomorphisms from the fundamental groupoid of the surface with its base set, so called V into G, or is simply G power k for some k, because the surface can be contracted to a graph. This thing, if you get this manifold, carries not quite a Poisson structure, but a quasi-Poisson structure. Quasi-Poisson structure is given by some intersection theorem on the surface, so it's just purely geometrical thing. And what does it mean that it's quasi-Poisson? You know, Poisson structures are supposed to be some shadow of associative structures, of star products. So if you have a deformation of the original product, then the first order term of the commutator is a Poisson structure. But now on this stuff, we have action of g power v. At each mark point, there is an action of g. There's a remain who can change those trivialization. And what you want to get, you want to persuade C infinity of this algebra, to be an associative algebra, but in this deformed world, with respect to this U, G, power V mode, H bar. So this associativity is now a difficult thing, it contains an associator. That's also why the Jacobian identity, which is normally satisfied by Poisson structure, becomes replaced by something, there's a right-hand side. It's a relatively simple right-hand side because it's only the first non-trivial term in an associator, which is always the same for every associator. And now, so what I can tell you that using this procedure without, for the first, modding out by this H, one quantizes these manifolds, and then when we finally choose some H inside of G power K, something which is quasi-tropic, then this modular space, this is in G power V. And this H is going to act as part of that on this modular space. So this becomes Poisson, the quasi-Poisson structure descends to a Poisson structure, and we get the quantization of this. And the very last thing, only for a couple of seconds, is example. Linking to this quantization of Hopf algebras, quantization of Lie by algebras, or quantization of Poisson Lie groups. The thing is, if you take for the surface a triangle, it's not a very difficult surface. Also, this G power K becomes G squared. There are just two homonyms. So that's all. But now we suppose that this G is actually the trivial double of our H. So say G contains H prime, and we need to model by some quasi-tropic subgroup now in G cube. And what we do, we model by two copies of H star and one copy of H. The outcome can be identified with H, because we have two copies of G, but we removed two copies of H star and only one copy of H, so one H remains. And this amount can be identified with H. The Poisson structure here is the Poisson structure on the Poisson Lie group H. And we get the quantization of this Poisson structure. And now I can compare finally though it's not clear how it's happening. This approach and the approach of, I think, of Cardano, because in this, in what I was telling you, this, how it's happening is that we say modeled by A star, we don't do anything, so these are just two copies of H, but then we take the tensor product of these two things, it becomes a triangle, and then finally we model by H. So somehow it corresponds to splitting the triangle like this. Whereas to finish in a mysterious note, if one tries to look at what's happening in Etienkov and Cardano from this point of view, they're kind of doing the same thing, but they're splitting in this way. So finally one can say that to finally compare the approach that I told you about and the approach of Cardano, one should understand in what sense this quantization of modular spaces is independent of the way how we grew them from some simple parts using those tensor products. Okay, so thanks.
Questions or comments?
The construction does not work in any dimension, including it.
This quantization of Libra doesn't.
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes.
Can we do this great quantization of from Markov Libra?
This I don't know how to do it. It's
a formula that's not construction, you can make it too. But it's not clear how this
works. For me, it's not clear. I don't know how to massage this thing to work.
You can get some air with you, not just the part.
So you said that at the end, the quantization of the Kadikos structure depends on the way you decompose the surface. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the oscillator. And there is similar situation with the same data and the same kind of result using a kind of extension of the constraint integral by Anderson, Mathes, and Marchetti. So is there some connections is it difficult to compare maybe?
It looks in a way similar, but I don't know whether they're somehow equal in some sense, but it's just because I didn't maybe try too hard to check. But I think what is happening in this case, in their case, there are no marked points on the boundary, so it's a surface with boundary, and they're quantizing that, which is not fine in this. You can just model by all those G's which are there. Here, this is certainly a quasi-truly subgroup. You know. G power V inside of G power V is a quasi-truly subgroup that we can do. But I don't know whether it's the same thing, because they're building the surface out of some hexagons and squares, whereas what we're using this fusion thing, so we're building the surface out of diagons. These are some of the basic building blocks, and then the operations which are being performed. So we take a surface with two mark points and then replace it with a single mark point on the boundary. So there are some different geometric pictures happening there. So since the geometry is different, I cannot really compare.
Any further questions? Thanks again.